Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So I'm very pleased to introduce the moderator of our next panel on healthcare. And originally, I must say that Will Dow was going to moderate. But one of our panelists, Gene Ross from the California Budget Project, had to withdraw at the last minute because of family reasons. And Will was very kind and agreed to step in as a panelist, which he could easily do. So thank you very much, Will, for doing that. And then Karen Shore, who is from the California, let me make sure I got the name right, Health Policy Forum, was kind enough to agree to step in at the last minute and help us out and take over as moderator in Will's place. So thank you very much, Karen, for that. Just tell you a word about her. You'll find a bio about Karen in the program, but it's an insert, so you have to have to look a little bit for it. But it's in there. She is the Vice President for Planning and Health Policy for the Center for Health Improvement, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the nation's health. And one of Karen's roles as Vice President at the Center for Health Improvement is to run the California Health Policy Forum, which describes itself as an independent platform for education, idea sharing, and conversations among legislative and executive branch health policy staff about the complex issues facing the state today. And I really want to thank you sincerely for stepping in and helping us out, Karen, and I know you'll be a great moderator. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. And welcome, everyone. Again, I'm Karen Shore from the Center for Health Improvement in Sacramento. And as was said, I direct the California Health Policy Forum. And if you're interested in some of the work that we're doing, you can check out our website. You can either go to the Center for Health Improvement's website or CAHPF.org, and have some interesting policy briefs and recordings of sessions on topics on health information technology and the safety net and health reform and other exciting topics. So again, welcome to the panel on healthcare. It's an exciting time, I think, in California and the nation in terms of healthcare. It's also a little scary. So I think that probably everyone has heard that, you know, we have a $25 billion deficit in the state, and we're looking for ways to make that up with a combination of programmatic cuts and raising revenue. So I guess finding the balance there is the big challenge. Before I make some remarks, I want to introduce our panel. So I'm going to give the editorial version of the introduction since you have the nice bios in your packet. So to my immediate left is Stan Rosenstein, and he is Mr. Medi-Cal. So he Sacramento institution and ran the Medi-Cal program for a very long time. And then Tom McCurdy is a professor from Stanford. And I'm sorry that that's all I know about him so far. But perhaps more will be revealed soon. And and then next is Will Dow, who's a professor here at Berkeley in the program that I completed at UC Berkeley in Health Services and Policy Analysis and the Demographic Center as well. Is that right? And then last is Leif Haas, a fellow Sacramento policy wonk. Worth the New America Foundation. So lots of great analysis and work that they're doing. So welcome, everybody, all the panelists. And let me just make some introductory remarks to get everybody up to speed on healthcare programs and spending in California. And this is largely taken from our friends at the Legislative Analyst's Office, which is a great resource on this topic. So in 2009 to 10, spending on health and social services departments and entities was estimated to be about $25 billion, which is almost 30% of statewide general fund expenditures. But when considering special funds, federal funds, and the general fund, total expenditures are at $70 billion, or 36% of budgeted spending in California. So a huge amount of money, a third of the budget. And the Department of Healthcare Services accounts for a very significant portion of that, 44% of general fund spending and 60% of total spending. The remainder goes to the Department of Social Services, the Departments of Developmental Services, and Mental Health. We get a lot of federal funding. It's the single largest source of funds for health and social services programs in California. It comes to us through many different streams and with complicated rules and differing rules and requirements for the various programs. In terms of major health programs in California, we have health care services provided to welfare recipients and other qualified low-income persons, primarily families with children and then folks who are aged, blind, or disabled. We have community-based and institutional services for persons with developmental disabilities, community-based and institutional services for people with mental illnesses, and subsidized health insurance for children from low-income families, and then a broad range of public health programs. One of the state's major health programs is the Medicaid program, which is known here as Medi-Cal, and it currently covers about 7.5 million Californians. Is that one in four or five? A huge number. And Medi-Cal provides health care services to qualified low-income people, again, primarily families with children and the aged or disabled. And it covers a wide range of required services that are required from the federal government, so hospital, inpatient and outpatient care, skilled nursing care, doctor visits. And then California also provides optional services. So they're not mandated by the federal government to provide these, but California does provide them, such as coverage of prescription drugs and durable medical equipment. And California also has expanded eligibility for the program beyond what is required by federal law. One of the things that has been talked about in Sacramento recently, there have been a lot of budget committee hearings, and many beneficiaries of health and social services programs receive assistance from two or more of those programs at the same time. So particularly important in an era of budget cuts, it's not just that you suddenly have to pay $5 when you go to the doctor under Medi-Cal, but you also may be getting lower payments under other programs and similar benefit reductions. And so on the topic of cuts, I think even the governor used the word draconian to describe the cuts that he was proposing in the budget. And he has proposed a total of $1.7 billion coming from the Medi-Cal program, which I think everyone thinks is a pretty huge number. And so there are also additional cuts to other health-related programs, including Healthy Families, which covers children of low and moderate income families. So the Medi-Cal cuts include reduced payments to providers, and California is not known for its generosity in payments to Medi-Cal providers already. And then limits on the number of doctor visits that are allowed, which would be 10 per year, and the number of prescriptions, which would be 6 per month. Also shifting costs to beneficiaries through increased copayments for when you go to the doctor, when you use the emergency room, and when you have a hospital stay, and then also eliminating coverage for adult day healthcare services. So not a very uplifting introduction, I'm sorry to say, but tremendous discussion in Sacramento about what's really needed to be provided in these programs and then what's going to happen in terms of cuts now and then potentially further cuts if the special election doesn't work out in June. So with that, let me turn it over to Stan.
Thank you very much for having me and opportunity to talk. And I want to set some context for the maybe generally about the state budget and the Medi-Cal budget. You know, having worked for 31 years in the state and 13 years running Medi-Cal, I actually had the I wouldn't say the privilege, the necessity of putting together many state budgets. And I certainly know how they go, and I think it's important to really understand the context of where are we at today. Everybody talks about a $25 billion deficit, that humongous number, but really we're in, I guess, what I would call a perfect storm right now of problems, and I'll talk about what they are. In 2007, if somebody was up here talking about the state budget, they would be talking about a $105 billion general fund budget. Today, people are talking about a $90 billion general fund budget. That's actually up from last year by $5 billion. The revenue is actually up some. But you can see there's, in the course of 4 years, the state has $15 billion less revenue. So it's no surprise that everybody's talking about cuts. We have that much less revenue, and that's after $12 billion of temporary tax increases. So in the nature of, of not having money, everyone's being cut. There's no escaping it. The problems the states face is governors and legislatures. California hasn't done this recently, but governors and legislatures have to balance their budgets. They can't borrow money. They can't print money like the federal government. Constitutionally, California is supposed to balance its budget. So what do you do if you're in a situation where you've got $15 billion less to spend and you've suffered through, inflation? And then to combine that, the perfect storm, you've got demand that is up. California population continues to grow. Unemployment is very high in California. It's a major driver of the need for benefits, especially when you get to the Health and Human Services area. You can directly correlate Medi-Cal enrollment with unemployment. And that's why Medi-Cal is up by about 1 million people now from where it was 2 years ago when I left state government. The worst part about all this is when unemployment starts to drop, it lags 2 years before caseload starts to drop. So we are in this problem for a long-term problem. The last part of the perfect storm, Congress and the stimulus bill, was very, very helpful to states in maintaining programs. They gave California over $3 billion of additional aid for Medi-Cal a year. Some of that money flowed to the University of California. They gave a lot of money in education. That money is all ending June 30th of this year. It started to end now. So what that means is for those people who thought that Medi-Cal was the hog that ate the money last year and the year before, the actual state general fund for Medi-Cal went down by $3 billion because they had the federal stimulus money. The problem is it's all gone, and so this, the Medi-Cal program requires, just for basic caseload, basically what it has, 30% more general fund next year than the year before. So the folks who are trying to fund Medi-Cal have to find 30% more general fund than it had before. So you can see it's just a perfect storm. It's just horrible what's going on. And we had the conversation about MOEs a little while ago. There was a big MOE on Medi-Cal, Medicaid stateswide. You can't reduce eligibility. So what does Congress do? They extended the MOE, but they did not extend the funding. So now California's got an MOE on eligibility that goes through 2013, but Congress took away the funding to pay for it. So be careful with MOEs because they can come back to you and hurt you a lot, and it hurts California. The Republican governors nationally are just outraged and at war on this MOE because now they got the MOE without the money. It limits it. But what it really means is that you can't take people off of eligibility for Medi-Cal or Medicaid until 2013 when health care reform kicks in. So, it's a very tough budget for Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal is the second to largest general fund expenditure in the state. K-12 is the highest. So, and if you look at the latest statistics on Medi-Cal, it's half of Health and Human Services after the stimulus money kicks in, if you look at next year, because replacing the stimulus money. It is the largest program the state runs. I mean, most of K-12 education, the state gets the money and they hand it out to local school districts. Your money they hand out. The two programs that the state really runs itself is Medi-Cal and the prisons. And with Medi-Cal much bigger, especially when you add in the federal money. And just to let you know, the federal money comes in about $35 billion a year of federal money to California. Medi-Cal would be at at $17 billion in the proposal without the cuts, and it's like, you know, it'd be $19.7 billion. Actually, there's another billion I'll talk about of reductions in Medi-Cal. Also, Medi-Cal is the engine of the healthcare economy. Actually, Medicaid nationally is 1/6 of the national healthcare expenditures. It's bigger than Medicare now. People don't realize it. Covers, as mentioned, over 1 in 5 people in California are on Medi-Cal. The University of California, not the academic side, but the hospital side, gets tremendous support from Medi-Cal. You wouldn't have UC hospitals without Medi-Cal. Big funding, not state funding, I might add. State doesn't put any money in, but big federal money. 40% of the births in California is funded by Medi-Cal. 60% of the nursing home care. 40% of the children in California are on Medi-Cal. So you can see the reach of how this program really covers and affects everybody. And, you know, part of the problem with the program is most of the people are low income, low assets, and so they don't have much of a lobby. That's why they can be put as a target. You know, the only lobbies, there are some advocacy lobbies, not as strong as other programs, you know, providers, and we'll lobby some, but, you know, it's an organization, a program that's not well known, and not the lobbyists, and people think it's welfare still, and so it does not poll well. So if you were a Governor Brown and you put forth, I want a tax extension for Medi-Cal, you would lose. You know, tax extension for education is far more popular. So that's why Medi-Cal, part of the reason, I'm not speaking for the governor, I couldn't speak for the governor, but part of the reason Medi-Cal does poorly is it polls very poorly. People don't appreciate the program. They don't know the program. And it is, just a tremendous engine for federal money. It is the largest federal revenue sharing program in the nation. It's the largest source of federal funds to the state of California. But there's a catch. To get a dollar of federal funds, you have to spend a dollar of state or local funds. And the problem is, if you don't have that dollar of state or local funds, you can't get the federal money. And you know, when you're broke, you don't have it. California has operated the Medi-Cal program very differently than other state Medicaid programs. A lot of states will look at Medicaid as a engine to bring in the federal money to have a robust health care system. So if you go to New York State, they've got an abundance of hospitals because they decided we're going to invest and figure out ways to play a Medicaid game to get a lot of federal money, and they have robust hospitals. California, for a lot of reasons, decided not to do that. So we have a lot of closed hospitals in California. We've suffered some, and that's why, we suffer quite a bit because Medi-Cal was always viewed as a financial burden to the state. I could hear our discussions this morning, and people still have a bit of a financial burden, and the budget operates that way. But it is a problem because we lose a lot of money on the table that California could have. California is a low receiver of overall federal funds. California has squeezed its budget since Ronald Reagan was governor. I can think of 2 years, and I was 31 years in the Medi-Cal program. I can think of 2 years of where Medi-Cal didn't squeeze its budget out of 31. So it is really tough to cut Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal gave its last across-the-board increase to providers who provide services, doctors, dentists. Last across-the-board increase was once in 2000 since 1985. So how would you feel if you had one raise since 1985? That's what the physicians have had. The governor has put on the table, it's not a new proposal, it's been adopted before, a 10% reduction. That actually, I heard someone say, that reduces the rate back to about 1985 levels of payment. So that tells you how bad things are at in the program. Some basic statistics. Medi-Cal is the lowest per enrollee spending program in the nation. Spends less per person in the nation. And I could have said that 15 years ago. There's only 1 year in the last 15 years I couldn't say it. I think one federal official once said that Medi-Cal was 51st in falling. You'll remember that. What people don't understand is we actually have the highest percentage of our population covered in of any state. So we are very low spending per person. I would argue somewhat efficient. Providers pay underpayment. And then when you look at it overall to say, how does it fall as a tax burden for the public? It's about average cost among the states per resident. So it spends a lot, or covers a lot of people for very low cost and average tax burden. That's combined with the fact that California suffers from a very low federal matching rate. The way the federal government says is they'll, you spend a dollar, they'll apply a percentage called the FMAP. And some states get 75-80% of the dollar they spend back. California, June 30th, will get 50%. And that's because the federal formula has been flawed. The General Accounting Office found that years ago. It underestimates or underweights the value of California having such a high rate of poverty. California's got a lot of wealthy people, but a lot of people in poverty. That formula doesn't average, nor is the fact that we've got a large poverty group. The federal laws on Medicaid are enormously complex. Heard the last presenter talk about maybe that's good, you can really restrict things. Well, you know, the problem with that is the state is so restricted, it has very few options. The federal law says now you can't reduce eligibility. So California's got a high eligibility level, low per enrollee, but California cannot roll back its eligibility. So what can it do? It's got optional benefits. You can eliminate optional benefits. It's got cost sharing. It can set provider rates. So when you look at the services, you can say, well, I can reduce what I pay providers, I can reduce the services, or I can reduce who I provide services to. Two of those options are eligible. So Governor Brown, very similar to what Governor Schwarzenegger did, very similar to what Governor Wilson did, or so Governor Davis did. It's not much new here. Proposed eliminating more optional benefits. There was a day in my time when we talked about eliminating adult dental. You know, people getting dental services were, you know, a lot of us think that is important. I never thought that would happen in my career. It's happened now. People on Medi-Cal can't get adult dental. That's how desperate things are. Now the Governor Brown has proposed additional reductions in benefits. He's proposed, well, I'm going to cap benefits. Other states do it. If you go to some states, you can't get more than 2 prescriptions a month. Governor Brown has proposed 6 prescriptions per month cap. He's proposed eliminating or more cost sharing. You know, there's a lot of belief that people who are on Medi-Cal overutilize services, and so one of the techniques that people use to control those overutilized services is to say you're going to pay a share of it. And he's proposed a 10% rate reduction. That's been done before, stopped by the courts. That issue's up at the U.S. Supreme Court, will be decided next fall. You know, it's not that complicated when you put a budget together. You need a number, and, you know, they got to do something, and rates are a big number, so it's about $1.7 billion. The other big reduction is the governor has proposed to go to the ballot, the second part of the ballot, and take Prop 10 money, the first five money, take $1 billion of that and use it to fund Medi-Cal. So he was actually short when he put the budget together, $2.7 billion for Medi-Cal. And you can see why, because, you know, all of a sudden they lost $3 billion of federal money. It's not a big secret, you know, when you follow the math. So Medi-Cal, you know, when you're broke, it's hard to find money to replace the loss of federal money. And, you know, if Medi-Cal would have not taken that burden themselves, where have they gone? K-12 education, more from the universities. You know, they've already taken all the other health and human services programs down as much as they probably can. I think if you would have been in the Capitol, I was over there yesterday, $750 million out of the development of the disabled program. There were 2,000 people in the Capitol that yesterday, just to give you the sense of how bad things are. So there's not a lot of options. You know, people could say you should manage care better. That's a very viable option. I think everybody would agree with that. They've already reduced, in the prior budget, Medi-Cal expenditures for the most disabled population by 10% to do that. So that cut was taken last year. So, you know, all of the things about can you manage better, they've already reduced it. Anti-fraud, it's another area that is very much very ripe. And California is very aggressive on fraud. It's very real, and they've taken a lot of reductions in that area. And so I guess the overall challenge is when you've got, just to conclude, you've got the lowest per enrollee spending program in the nation. You got a program that the federal government will not let you take people off the program. You've already proposed 10% reductions for better management of care. There's not a lot left. And Medi-Cal, because it's second to largest program in the state, has got to take a share. So I guess that's, let me summarize there and turn it over.
Thanks, Dan. Tom McCurdy from Stanford.
Hi. I should give you a little background. It is true I'm a professor of economics at Stanford, but really Henry asked me to do this mostly because I work a lot for the federal government. So I kind of come from the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where I do a lot of work in terms of designing payment policies. So I want to repeat a few of the things that Stan said, but give a slightly different perspective. As he mentioned, the governor's budget proposals are essentially to propose to cut Medi-Cal by $1.7 billion. Just to give you an idea of what the distribution of that is across the various kind of cuts, there's imposing caps, which is basically how many services you can get. That's about 13%. Copays is about 33%. Reducing benefits, meaning some services won't be provided, that's 11%. And then provider payment reductions, that's 42%. So that's where the bulk of the savings or the cuts are essentially coming in, imposing copays and payment reductions. And the thing, as Stan noted, I mean, that's a $1.7 billion cut from the state's perspective. You double that for how much Medi-Cal spending will go down, because pretty much all of that is a federal match. Now, one thing I want to kind of emphasize is it's very unlikely that the state is going to be able to make any of these cuts. They're proposed. They've all been proposed in the past, and there's reasons for why they haven't done it before. Let me go through them. First of all, let's take the imposing caps. The sort of cap that you have is individuals can have 10 office visits or clinical visits over the year. That's nice. What are you going to do with a diabetic? I mean, how one's actually going to operationalize these isn't very clear at this point. I mean, you're going to put them into hospitals. I mean, so their caps, how they impose it, especially on the fee-for-service side, it's never clear how you're going to accomplish them. Now, having said that, that's 13%, so there's a lot of money there, but there are prescription drug caps in terms of how many prescriptions you can get. So the question is, who's going to come in and say which drugs you don't get? So there's going to be a challenge there because problems on the management side. What about the copays and the benefit reductions? Most of those aren't going to be enforced. The difficulty is the copays are, you can exceed the federal waivers on the copays, and I think I looked it up, and I think for the emergency rooms you can maybe go to $6 for a copay. I think the standard is $3. The governor's proposing $50. So, I mean, they can't do it now unless the federal government does something. You can't accomplish most of those copays. The other problem you have is the Affordable Care Act, as was mentioned, essentially dictates that there can't be anything that reduces eligibility or kind of maintain effort sort of thing, and the copays are viewed explicitly as reducing eligibility. So they're proposed. It's not clear that without federal permission, they can't be invoked, and it's not clear that federal permission is going to be forthcoming. It has been in the past. What about the reducing of provider reimbursements? As was mentioned, the state did this, the legislature did this in 2008. They were sued by the providers. They lost in local federal court. They went through the appeals court. They're now the Supreme Court has now indicated that they're willing to look at this case, which will be decided in the fall. It's not clear how that'll work. Even if it goes through, you have to get permission from CMS can still step in and say you can't cut it. And it's against the law, according to the Affordable Care Act. Affordable Care Act says you can't do this. So there's going to be another provision there. And the providers can go into state court. So the notion that this is going to be done by a year from now is pretty optimistic. It's not really clear how that's going to happen. Just to give you an idea of what the provider benefits are for providers in the state that do Medi-Cal, if you take all services, it's roughly about half Medicaid reimbursement, Medicare reimbursement. So Medi-Cal rates are about half Medicare reimbursements. And for other states, they're about three-quarters of the rest of Medicaid. Now, they differ by service and the like, but that gives you a ballpark idea. Now, if the legislature is able to accomplish the benefit reductions, then we'll probably get more savings than they propose because we're going to have providers drop out of the system. So there's going to be less access and less services. So that in that regard, if it's accomplished, it'll be probably a larger projection than what they have listed. Okay. Now, challenges going forward. I mean, so the first point is that, you know, the reductions that have been proposed are going to be hard to accomplish. And going forward, we have huge challenges above and beyond what even Stan mentioned. First of all, let me note that 60% of Medi-Cal expenditures go to the top 5% of enrollees. 40% are spent on the top 2%. We have the bottom three-quarters of Medicare enrollees spend 6% of the budget. So if you were to cut the services in half for 75% of the population, you'd cut Medi-Cal expenditures by 3%. All the money is in the aged, the blind, the disabled. So if you don't go after services there, you're not cutting the budget. And you guys can think on your own as to how one does that. But we're not talking about services on the margin here for the bulk of the population, because the bulk of the population is not very expensive. Once again, three-quarters spend 6% of the budget. So that means as this policy tool, you have to realize it's those high-cost users that you're really going to have to figure out some mechanism to be able to slow up the service provision, and that's going to be a serious challenge. Just to give you an idea, the blind and the aged account for 51% of the top in the top category. So these are like the most ill individuals. And we can talk about managing their care, and we've had lots of quality of care and management care, but those don't systematically. CBO has a number of studies on these that indicate they don't save money. So it is a very serious challenge. California's also been shifting to managed care, but there's a lot of evidence that managed care hasn't saved money. Essentially, we've probably moved from about 20% of the population of enrollees on managed care to 40%. There's estimates in the literature that suggest for every beneficiary you shift over, it costs Medi-Cal about 20%. And you can dispute those numbers, but it's higher, it's not lower. And there's been this notion of shifting people over to managed care and saving money, but those haven't been realized. And there's really good reasons for why. I mean, Medi-Cal is not like the private system. So first of all, as I just mentioned, the reimbursement rates on fee-for-service are low, so there's not much negotiating room that managed care has. That's one problem. Two is you already have pre-authorization on the private side in major ways, which you don't have in Medicare fee-for-service. I mean, to be able to get services within a hospital, Medi-Cal already has individuals who are basically keeping track of that sort of thing and have to have a pre-authorization. So that's another reason for why you can't achieve the savings. The other thing too is Medicare managed care can't do cost sharing the way regular managed care can do. Then the last part is there are carve-outs in the California system. What that means is for certain kinds of illnesses and high-cost services, the managed care systems can shove individuals off into the fee-for-service sector. So this notion that we've been moving people to managed care and saving money just hasn't been achieved, and there's no reason, and there's good reason to understand why it hasn't been achieved. Now, there's options for redesigning managed care to try to save money. You can prove risk adjustments and do something on the carve-outs, but that's a program redesign, and it's serious challenges to do that. And then we have the challenges of healthcare reform coming up. Just to give you a sense of what will happen there, beginning January 1st, 2004, virtually every person under 65, up to 133% of the poverty level, has to be covered. And there's no asset restrictions anymore. So that is going to put individuals on the Medi-Cal roll. The estimates are that, oh, and also, by the way, there's also additional benefits that Medi-Cal now will have to cover under the Affordable Care Act, such as freestanding birth clinics, selected prescription drugs have to be made available, preventive services for adults, so there's going to be an extra service provision as well. There's new administrative costs. There's data systems that people have to have, et cetera, that Medi-Cal has to have, so there's extra costs on that side. Question is, how will it be financed? Well, in principle, the federal government is supposed to pay for it up to 2016. After that, the federal government is supposed to pay 90%. The state's supposed to pay 50%. The estimates are, if you can't, there are varying estimates, but it's anywhere from 3%, 4%, 5% in terms of increased extra growth in Medi-Cal just accounting for these kinds of services. And that's assuming you think the federal government's going to pay. I mean, I don't know who here thinks they are, but if you don't know, they're cutting all over the place. So how those are going to be covered, nobody has a clue. And we're talking about huge amounts of money in terms of what's involved here. Also, the other part that doesn't get mentioned is the CHIP program. I mean, the federal government only guarantees CHIP under the Affordable Care Act up to 2015. After 2015, the state is obligated to cover all of the CHIP program, and it has CHIP is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Healthy Families is what it's called in California, and that is money where, and there's a maintenance of effort on that as well. So there are the challenges that the legislature faces in Medi-Cal are just overwhelming. I mean, I think they're totally overwhelming. But and certainly you can do some redesigns of the program. But one of the things that's going to have to be done is to go get federal relief. There has to be some changes in federal law so the state really does have options to change copays and to pay reimbursements and to change the service provisions that it does. Because without it, the state's tried to make changes before and they're blocked. So unless there's some kind of change of the federal system and change there, it's going to be very, it's already a challenge. It's almost impossible to achieve this. I wouldn't have a clue as to how to do this. So, thanks.
Next is Lee Haas from the New America Foundation.
Just get my slides up here and maybe take down the 2-minute warning sign. I think after you hear me, you already wish I was at 2 minutes, but that's another story. So just get the clicker. See if we can. Oh, I'm going to try. Don't worry. But Tom McCurdy has already blown my best ideas out of the water, so it's a considerable challenge. Thank you all for being here, and thanks to Mr. Travers and his family and to the program for putting on this terrific event. Healthcare and health reform are at an odd crossroads. I guess they're always at an odd crossroads, but it's particularly strange now. When I go to D.C. and certain parts of the country, there's considerable enthusiasm, mixed naturally with anxiety, about expanding insurance coverage under the recently enacted Affordable Care Act. To evoke a well-known medical doctor, Dr. Jekyll, this is the Dr. Jekyll face of healthcare. It's cautiously optimistic and forward-looking. But in Sacramento and other state capitals and elsewhere in the country, the discussion of healthcare is much more in common with the face of Dr. Hyde. It's discussions of pain and harm caused and cutting programs to the bone and only with faint hope of light at the end of the tunnel. It's very odd, the juxtaposition of this federal implementation and the state fiscal crises. And just as an aside, it's potentially very dangerous to the implementation politically of the Affordable Care Act. But in tough fiscal times and with budget balancing requirements, there are very few immediate things to do, as we've already heard, other than to propose cutting benefits removing beneficiaries from the rolls and paring back payments to doctors and other providers. And all of that, unhappily, the Brown budget does. What I hope to do in the next few minutes is to run through a few ideas, short run, medium term, that could greatly improve upcoming California budget cycles in terms of paying for health care, with an emphasis on the fact that it's hard to bring down costs, either for the state or for private payers, without changing how we pay for health care and how we deliver care. So starting with the first slide, what California shares most with other states, as you've heard, is that at least on paper, health care and human services are on the chopping block, and they will be for the near future. Roughly half the cuts in Governor Brown's budget are in this area of health and human services, mostly to Medi-Cal. In the 2012 budget, half of these are provider payments, which we've heard the courts have disallowed in the past. And similarly, 31 states in the country have thus far released budget proposals for 2012. 28 are in the red, and more than half of those are contemplating severe reductions to Medicaid. And of those, state revenues are recovering somewhat. They're 15% lower than 2 years ago and may take 5 years to get back to their 2008 levels. What's also true, and this is interesting, is that the public doesn't want these cuts, even to health programs for low-income individuals. Take a look, for instance, at the rather remarkable consistency in this recent Pew study of five very different states. Roughly half of the respondents in each state want to protect K through 12 education, and over a quarter Medicaid. And for this reason, I think cuts either in California or elsewhere rarely happen at the level that they're first proposed, although this year may be the exception. And just to give you a sense of how serious these cuts might be, even before the recession, if you look there at the far right in this international comparative study, 39% of low-income Americans went without needed medical care because of costs. So you can imagine if these cuts continue to go through, the piling of additional hardship on individuals for whom the healthcare system is almost already completely broken. We looked a little bit at how California is the same. And let's look for a minute about how financing healthcare in California is different. First of all, we've got more systems, multi-specialty groups, integrated healthcare systems, such as Kaiser Permanente and others in the Southland, that coordinate and integrate care and deliver it, I'd argue, more inexpensively and effectively. The state also recently negotiated a waiver that could result in $10 billion in federal funding, about $5 billion of it new, that will allow a number of county health initiatives that have provided health insurance to low-income Californians to endure, maybe even to expand, and to help preserve the safety net of public hospitals. On the other hand, even if federal reform is enacted as written, California will still have more undocumented immigrants who will lack insurance coverage than many states have uninsured in the first place. And the other thing is that we've heard that California already has very low-cost public programs for health care, which makes it quite difficult to cut further, and you've heard this from Stan and Tom. By contrast, in particular, to New York State, where Medicaid alone is almost 40% of the state budget and annual spending is almost $10,000 per beneficiary, California stands in stark contrast. As you see on the slide, these are the top 10, California's peers, the top 10 spending states. And of course, actually, as you've heard from Stan, California is now 50th out of 50 among all states. This notwithstanding, I think there are some short-term fixes, and these are not necessarily this year's budget, but they're sort of intermediate term, that can be and probably should be tried. Lowering provider payments or attempting to do it is a must. And the hope this won't entirely eliminate the already thin provider networks for Medi-Cal patients, especially for specialists. And I think there's a big opportunity, though it doesn't save enormous numbers of dollars, to streamline enrollment and eligibility for public programs, although this may require a significant amount of upfront funding, which the state doesn't have, to get better results later. For instance, the state depends currently on three different county consortia to determine eligibility for Medi-Cal. It has a separate vendor to handle eligibility and enrollment for healthy families, as we just heard, the state Children's Health Insurance Plan. And Tom has already blown this out of the water, but we're going to keep trying it. The state continues to increase enrollment in Medi-Cal managed care, a fixed payment per beneficiary which I argue here has been shown to lower costs for beneficiary, and we could probably spend the day arguing about that, and Tom is completely right. We'd have to change program design to make it work completely. But as you see in this slide, and this emphasizes the point that's been made earlier, only about the Medi-Cal enrollees, about 20% of the enrollees account for roughly 70 to 80% of the spending, which, of course, is an enormous challenge in terms of getting those costs down. There are also, I think, some possibilities, especially if federal health care reform is implemented, to actually consolidate or eliminate programs and agencies. You can think about Mr. MIB, which is our high-risk pool, and this may well be superseded by federal reform. There are also, I would argue, redundant agencies in state government, such as the DOI and the DMHC, both agencies that regulate health care plans. And these are important things to look at, even though they don't save the sort of billions that we'd need. Even in the middle term, however, we won't be able to do much about health spending until we take on directly the way we currently pay for care and through changing the incentives for physicians, which in turn we hope will change the ways they practice toward a more efficient use of resources and one aimed more at better health care outcomes rather than performing a high volume of procedures. Unless costs come down over time, unless we do more with less, as we heard in the education panel, the promise of affordable coverage under federal health reform or under any system simply won't materialize. So I'm going to conclude with the next few slides in the next few minutes with a brief but extended digression on why health costs are so high and what we might, as a state and nationally, be able to do about them. As you know, and as this sort of celestial navigation slide shows, the U.S. Spends roughly twice per capita of other industrialized nations without getting better health care results. If you see in this slide, there's a little dip in the 90s where we went much more toward managed care, if you look on the right. But otherwise, costs are growing in all countries, in the U.S. more than any other one. And the root of the cost problem, and this is what I want to emphasize, is that we pay on a piecework basis through fee-for-service payment and at very high prices and using very expensive machines to treat patients with multiple chronic conditions that would benefit most from a more coordinated approach to care. Over 70% of our health care costs stem from the impact of chronic illness, frequently among patients with multiple conditions. And half of our health care costs probably can be linked to five or six chronic illnesses, hypertension, diabetes, asthma, and congestive heart failure, which aren't treated best, as we do now, complication by complication, but through a combination of lifestyle change, adherence to drug regimens, and a close relationship to particular primary care providers, which is what, in general, our specialist-dominated, procedure-oriented health system almost lacks entirely, except in a few isolated integrated health systems, such as the Geisinger Health Plan and Kaiser and Intermountain Health in Utah. We haven't been able to do much about this because at the end of the day, doctors, by and large, are paid more to do more. Reimbursements for primary care and for linkages in care, like the care transition from a hospital to a home setting, are paid on pennies in the dollar compared to specialist episodic care, or not at all. And here you see that this slide, which is pretty much constant over the years, shows the impact of the chronic conditions that about 10% of all patients are responsible for anywhere 50 to 60% of all spending. And so at the end of the day, you all know the old story of Willie Sutton, that he robbed banks because that's where the money is. This is in some way the key slide because you see that about 60% of U.S. healthcare spending is for hospital and physician services. So to really make a dent, short run, middle run, long run, we're going to have to get at those sources. We're going to have to dig into those sources of spending and get real payment reform. And this isn't just a hypothetical thing we've been doing in California, or maybe hypothetical, but one of the ways we were trying to get at this at New Americas in the last 2 years, my colleagues and I put together a project that brought together the state's leading hospital administrators, insurance executives, physicians, and consumer advocates, and looking largely at different ways projecting different ways of changing, especially payments, of moving toward bundled payments for services, of trying to get people, you know, healthier by changing their environment. We projected that we could save $305 billion over a 10-year period. Now, admittedly, California is projected to spend about $2 trillion over that period, but this could get us down 6, 7, 8%, which would be a significant way to bend the curve. Now, are these innovations in payment, you know, going to work exactly as we think they are? Of course. No, there's a good news, bad news thing. We don't know. For instance, one of the big ideas in federal health care reform and out there, you know, at every conference now, are accountable care organizations, where doctors and physicians will come together, they'll get a bundled payment, and they'll work together, particularly with Medicare beneficiaries, to try to lower the cost of care. Good idea on paper. What might happen in practice? Those systems might actually consolidate their market power and drive up the price of the bundle or the price of services altogether. So there may be a lot of unintended consequences, but unless we try to get more coordinated and integrated care, we're not going to be able to get these costs down. Another thing we've done in California, and we're the first in the nation to do this after the Affordable Care Act, is to pass the law that enacted the California Health Benefit Exchange, basically an insurance store marketplace for individuals and employees of small firms. And there's a hope here, and we could talk about this in Q&A or at, you know, great and, you know, never-ending length, as we did in Sacramento, about the possibility of these exchanges for allowing, you know, plans to compete on price and quality and cost and to get costs down. And I'd have to, oh, yeah, look. But I think the final thing that gives me a bit of hope, this conference is supposed to be about hope, and I promised you, you know, Pollyanna, if not pipe dreams. There's the missing link in healthcare reform, and here is Aditi, the missing link, may well be the delivery reform ideas that might lead to more cost containment. We have in the federal law for the first time a comparative effectiveness institute, ways of really trying to compare treatments and procedures, not on cost yet, but on whether they work, which works better and which doesn't. This is something that every other industrialized country has, and we've never had it before now. There's a new Center for Medicare Innovation. There's a hospital value-based purchasing program and reducing avoidable readmissions. Now, the trick here is that all these are not heavily funded. They're unique. They're new. They involve ways of trying to get better value for spending. But as New America trustee Atul Gawande has written, one truly scary thing about health reform, far from being a government takeover, it counts on local communities and clinicians for success. And so all of these demonstrations, all these pilots, all these good ideas are going to have to trickle down through the system and get adopted at local hospitals and health systems to really get traction on this difficult issue. And one of the things that does give me hope here is that California has the building blocks in place to do it, maybe uniquely in the country. We have integrated delivery systems like Kaiser. We have 285 physician organizations in place that know how to price risk, that know how, at least on paper, to compete on quality and price. We've got the largest pay-for-performance experiment in the country operating right here in Northern California, run by the Integrated Healthcare Association. They're developing the experience and the data to carry out these changes. But ironically, none of these changes is by any means certain, even in California, since managed care and integrated systems have been in retreat even in their birthplace. But the provisions of the Affordable Care Act may give them a leg up. And this is not exactly on topic, but I know it's the burning question on your mind. Even if these fledgling ideas about delivery and spending take root, we're not sure whether the Affordable Care Act is going to remain intact. You've all heard about the recent court decisions. It was, of course, a major issue in the November elections. My feeling is that the support for this act is inching up, and you can see this in the polls, and that the challenges are more about stalling the Obama agenda rather than leading to actual recall. But very much this entire act does hang in the balance. But I would say that, as we've all seen, this problem is not going to go away. And to put something together that matches the scope of the problem, you're very likely at the end of the day to come up with something not too different from what is already in place. And if that is the case, I believe in this Jekyll and Hyde or Janus-faced picture of health form, perhaps the happy face will actually win out in the end. So thank you very much. Look forward to your questions.
Great. Thank you, Lee. And last but not least, Will Dow from UC Berkeley.
Okay, great. Thank you for inviting me. When I was asked a few days ago by Chris to step in and speak, and I looked at the list of speakers who were going to be here anyway, I thought long and hard before I agreed, because I didn't want to stand up here and repeat the types of ideas that they would have to say, because they are much more expert than I am at many of the details of the California budget. So what I'm going to do today instead is take a little bit more of a 30,000-foot view. It's a little bit more of a long-run view. So, you know, Leif, he sort of went through some of the sort of the short-run issues, and he moved on to the medium term. And I want to put this in a little bit larger perspective about where we're going. I mean, in the short term, there are terrible problems in addressing the budget. We're going to muddle through somehow, through some kind of cuts in benefits, certainly not through increased revenues in the short term, you know, maybe some increased revenues, but there are going to be a lot of benefit cuts. But the question is, what happens after that? So, you know, 3-5 years from now, revenues turn back up, and you know, we could expand the programs back to where we were. But is that what's going to happen? Is that what we want to happen? Is there going to be more expansions than that? And I imagine that many of you in the room have seen this particular graph, a variant of it, and this is just showing national health expenditures over time. If we go back to 1965, when Medicare and Medicaid were passed into law, we spent about 5% of our GDP on health care. We're now up to about 16%. Projections are that if we continue increasing along this trend, we're going to hit 25% of GDP in not too long, within a couple decades. So the question is, are we going to raise revenue nationally in order to hit that? Are we going to have major cuts in generosity of our public programs, as well as in what private individuals are purchasing for themselves? Or are we going to somehow bend this curve? And so Leif was talking at the end about, you know, potential ideas that we can use to reduce this long-run healthcare expenditure trend. But frankly, I'm not terribly optimistic that we have very good ideas right now that are politically feasible. And certainly what's in the federal health reform, the ACA, there's not a whole lot which is going to dramatically bend this cost curve, or at least what Congressional Budget Office, et cetera, are willing to score as having big impacts that could bring down this long-term cost growth. So what that implies is that we are going to have a major problem for many years that is only going to be getting worse and worse and worse. So we're going to get through these next couple of years somehow, but there is a much longer term issue. And there's always the question that arises, well, we have a crisis now. Should we be using the crisis to move towards some other equilibrium, or to put us on some other path, some other spending path, as the revenues come back up? And I think that is sort of the important tie-in to the short-term situation. Okay, so this is the sort of overall expenditures nationally. If we look at the federal budget, many of you are familiar with this as well, I'm sure, in this group. The dark line here is the historic percent of GDP, which is federal revenues, or around 18 to 20% of federal revenues. Historically, if we look at projected expenditures going on into the future decades from now, we see entitlement spending is going to be ramping up and up and up, and it's projected that in 50 years or so, the mandatory spending is going to equal 18 to 20% of GDP just by itself before we've even paid for everything else in the discretionary part of the federal budget and for net interest, et cetera. The vast majority of this increase is due to health care. So here's just pulling out the Social Security and Medicare pieces. You can see that Social Security is going to bump up a little bit with the baby boom, and then it sort of flattens out as the demography sort of evens out. But Medicare is going up and up and up because we have this long-term trend of increasing spending. this is what the projections are for the state Medicaid spending are as well. Okay, let's just assume we don't change eligibility and our general sort of generosity standards. Well, as technology is expanding, we're seeing increased spending year after year, and it's only going to be getting worse and worse and worse at the state level. Of course, we're seeing this on private budgets as well. So these are graphs. I say the bottom bars in each year are the cost of purchasing health insurance for a family of four, the average cost for purchasing insurance through your employer. Today, we're around $13,000 or so is what it costs. Okay. So think about that $13,000. It's sort of doubled in nominal terms, at least, over the last decade or so. Well, think about what that does to uninsurance rates. So why are more and more people dropping out of the formal insurance system? Well, because prices are going up and up and up. Right? So that's taking people out of the private insurance market. It's putting them onto uninsurance. It's putting them onto Medicaid. It's increasing the demand for more and more people to be on Medicaid. Furthermore, their interactions with anything that the public sector wants to do to tamp down spending in something like Medicaid, you can't do unilaterally just in the public system because you're relying on the same set of providers who are being paid a very different rate in the private system that's sort of going up and up and up, and you're relying on the same set of technology which is being provided in these same hospitals. So what's going on in the private healthcare system and the public healthcare system are very much integrally related, and there's only so much that we can do in the public system, as we've been talking about, unless we're taking on overall systemic reform, which, of course, is going to be quite tricky. So thinking more specifically, just I wanted to have a couple slides here about what's going on in California in particular. This is just a trend over the last decade or so of Medi-Cal enrollment, so California Medicaid enrollment. So we talked about what are some ways that we can reduce spending. Well, we can cut reimbursements to providers, et cetera, maybe. Well, we could potentially cut back enrollment, except that we have these maintenance of effort restrictions right now that the federal government has put on states that we're not allowed to cut back enrollment for the next several years. Well, if you look at what's happened over the last 10 years, we have increased Medicaid enrollment by over 20%. Okay, so that's a lot of money right there if you are willing politically to cut some of these people off of the public rolls, and if there are waivers which are forthcoming from Washington to do so. I'm not saying that's a good thing to do necessarily, but going back to 10 years ago is not sort of unheard of in terms of public generosity. It would certainly cause a lot of pain. We've sort of already seen this, these sort of graphs on spending per beneficiary, and this is just another graph that was referred to earlier on spending per resident in our Medicaid program. We're a little bit below the national average now, so we're not some. This is spending per resident on Medicaid, so we're a little bit below the national average. We're not a hugely generous state on this, but there is potentially room for going down in the short run if one wanted to. But in the long run, how are we going to deal with these sort of ever-increasing spending trends? Well, some people talk about the demand side, and this is sort of one of the options which is in the governor's budget, is that we are going to start increasing cost sharing for individuals in the Medicaid program. The amount of cost sharing that they're talking about is very small, so the revenue side of that cost sharing is just negligible, but individuals may be somewhat price elastic in the Medicaid program. More generally, people have talked about trying to expand cost sharing throughout the system as a way to try to reduce costs. And this is the sort of overall movement towards health savings accounts, et cetera, that the Republicans have been very much in favor of. But analyses of this suggest that if we were to raise cost sharing of everybody in a current PPO-type plan today up to levels which are consistent with sort of so-called high deductible plans today, we might reduce total spending in the country by 5% or so, which would be a lot. But that's a one-time reduction, right? That's an intercept shift down in our long-term trend. In a healthcare system where costs are going up 7, 8, 10% a year, Well, that's pretty well swamped pretty quickly in that long-term trend that I was looking at early on. So that's one of the areas which is probably not going to be most promising. A second general area that we can try is, as Leif was talking about, is sort of supply-side reforms. So can we squeeze some of the huge amount of inefficiency out of the healthcare system? And we know there is tremendous amounts of inefficiency. So there are estimates which are disputable, obviously, but that we could take 30% out of Medicare spending without harming health outcomes among Medicare enrollees. Now, the problem is, which 30%? And once we identify, how do we get it out of the system? But aside from that, details. We all know that there's a huge amount of waste in the system, and people are talking about these so-called ACOs, et cetera, and other ways of using bundled payment and new incentives on providers to make that system more efficient. There are very few studies which are showing evidence that that works yet. There's sort of pilot projects going on, et cetera, but it's not something that we're going to hang our hat on as saying, wow, this is the magic bullet. Right? There's promise there, but again, CBO isn't willing to score that as having humongous effects either. And if we want to talk about sort of international comparisons with what's going on in other countries, well, in general, the U.S. actually uses less units of health care than most European countries. We have fewer physician visits per capita. We have fewer hospital nights per person than most European countries, right? So it's not sort of overall utilization, which is just dramatically too high in the U.S., and we need to find ways of getting people to use less of. We have more use of specialists, for sure, and this gets back to sort of overall moving around the healthcare system, the mix of generalists versus specialists, and we have more use of high-tech care. Now, some of that high-tech care is very important, and it's worth it, and we don't want to get rid of, and we actually have better access in the U.S. than in other countries, and some of that high-tech care just frankly isn't particularly worth it given all of the trade-offs that we're facing. When you look at what Europe does, though, why does Europe spend so much less than we do on health care? It's in the prices primarily. So European prices are much, much lower than U.S. prices. And this is payment rates for specialists. This is what they're paying for all types of medical equipment, for drugs, et cetera. How do they do this? The government intervenes in price setting. So in some countries, there is actually the government is setting those prices and dictating those prices. In some countries, the government is sort of mediator in national sort of price negotiations. But effectively, there are government price controls in the healthcare sector. This is not something in the short run that we think is likely to be politically palatable in the U.S., and one can argue about whether it would have differential effects in the U.S. compared to other countries, given the different role of sort of money and the scope of money in politics, et cetera, and from lobbyists in this country. But that is what more and more people are sort of pointing to as the key. If we found a way to bring in some way of regulating prices, for example, prices of specialists, then perhaps we could start bringing down some of these costs. And it's not just the cost for the specialist, but it could be shifting who's going into specialties versus family versus sort of family practice, primary care, and that could shift the types of tests that people are ordering, et cetera. So there are sort of potential long-term benefits to that. But again, this is not something that's about to happen anytime soon in the U.S. So, in terms of what we can learn from Europe, I think some of the lessons are going to be limited applicability here. I'll just close on one other point. When I sort of read the theme of this meeting, there was so much emphasis on education. Well, in the long run, if we really want to bring down healthcare spending, and a lot of the sort of goals of our healthcare spending is to improve health as well. Well, what's the single most important thing we can do to bring down healthcare spending and improve health? Well, I would argue that in the long run, it's investing in education. So you invest in education, those individuals, as they move on through their life course, they're going to have higher earnings, so they're going to have more tax revenue, et cetera. They're going to be less likely to be falling onto the Medicaid program. They're going to be more likely to be able to provide for their elders in terms of some private provision of long-term care, et cetera, instead of the older generation relying on long-term care. So there are many, many pathways by which education is going to be important. And I will just sort of remind you that one of the keys to this, that why it's so important, is because as healthcare prices are going up and up and up, there are fewer and fewer people who are able to afford the health care. So if you look at this middle line right here, just to remind you, those of you who haven't seen these sort of graphs, that middle line is median income in California over several decades. And it's been relatively flat. Okay, so median income is relatively flat. Healthcare spending, premiums, et cetera, are going up like this. There are going to be more and more demand for cross subsidies of people below median income for healthcare, and there are going to be fewer and fewer people who are we're trying to tax in order to cross subsidize these people. And that is sort of again a volatile long term mix. If we look at here's just a couple of quick statistics which show high school dropouts versus high school graduates versus those with some college versus those with a bachelor's degree or more. The line on the left is the percent of individuals reporting themselves to be in fair or poor health. Okay? If you have a college education, you're about three times less likely to be reporting yourself in poor health than someone who's a high school dropout. The line on the right-hand side is the percent of individuals in each group who are Medicaid recipients. So if you're a high school dropout, among high school dropouts, almost half are on Medicaid. Among those individuals who have attained some college or more, only about 8%, according to this measure, are sort of on Medicaid. Right? So that is a huge shift in the potential public burden and the public transfers. And that is going to be sort of absolutely key as we go forward in the future to think about. And it doesn't help us in the short run in terms of our current crisis. But again, we are in a crisis situation. There's a time when we're going to be reallocating expenditures as the revenues turn back up again. And this should be part of the debate about putting in money in the short run on something like healthcare versus investing in the long run to reduce healthcare spending and improve all sorts of other outcomes that we get from education. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Will. So I think we're going to shift gears and have some questions. And I don't know if other folks are feeling this way, but I am definitely feeling some serious pessimism in the short run and some optimism in the long run. So appreciate the various panelists giving us all of those perspectives and thinking about what some of the more promising reforms that can happen in the long run. And I wanted to mention one thing that I think Leif mentioned, $10 billion Medi-Cal waiver that was approved last year, sending money our way. And a major component of that is, and I'm not really the world's expert on the Medi-Cal waiver, but luckily we have people who are. So my understanding is that there's a real emphasis on treating people who are the high utilizers and through something called the patient-centered medical home. And I don't think anybody touched on that, but something that is getting a lot of discussion nationally and also here in California, that for those people who not that everyone could benefit from this, and I think the work has been done more in populations that have chronic conditions that need management, but that there's a care team that's assigned that includes a doctor and often is doctor-led, but also includes nurses and health educators and social workers and other folks that really can take a more comprehensive approach to managing your health rather than just, as someone had said, sort of tackling each chronic disease manifestation as it happens. So taking a broader, like, keep you healthy perspective and managing your conditions rather than waiting until something terrible needs to be addressed. So I wanted to mention that, and then also just pick up on the theme of the accountable care organizations and as a potential long-term solution as well. As Leif said, we don't really know how those are going to work out, and they may end up increasing costs rather than decreasing costs, but I think there's a real desire there also to hold organizations accountable for the care of individuals that they're responsible for and getting paid for. Let's have just a couple minutes for a discussion among the panel. And I had a question just in the short run that I wanted folks to talk for a minute about. And it's the issue of the proposed cuts and whether the burden goes to the beneficiary or to the provider. In the proposed cuts, there is definitely some of each. And I have been going to a lot of meetings recently with safety net providers. So those are the folks who are community clinics and public hospitals and the folks that will take care of anyone who walks in their door, regardless of their ability to pay. And thinking about charging co-payments for beneficiaries, and if someone goes to a safety net provider and can't afford a cost-sharing payment, so then they are still seen by the provider. So then there's more of a shift to the provider there as well. So just kind of wanted people to comment on that and see if there are any solutions. And in the Governor Brown's, you can't propose a don't take away my program unless you propose an alternative. So,
Stan. Well, let me answer first. In terms of the co-pays, the answer is it depends on the provider. The federal law now allows providers for Medicaid to deny the access to the service if the person doesn't have the ability to pay the copay. So if you go to a public hospital or to an FQHC, it's going to, it's a $5 copay and the person can't pay it, most likely the provider is going to provide the care, and it's a $5 rate decrease. If you go to a local pharmacy, there's a potential that the pharmacy will say either you pay the copayment or you you don't get the service. That's what Medicare Part D does. Medicare moved 1.2 million people off of Medi-Cal into a program that had copays and made it mandatory, and people on Medicare who are dual eligible, 1.2 million, now have to pay the copays if they don't get a drug. So it depends. Some providers, it'll be a rate reduction, and some providers will demand the copay.
Yeah, I just wanted to note, we don't really have a lot of evidence on how responsive individuals are to copay, but one of the key things that we miss is a lot of, we do a lot of, individuals pay a lot now by queuing. That's what we do. You have to wait a long time to get an appointment, and you have to wait a long time to go to the emergency room, and so it's kind of real cost. So it's not the case as if, copays is just another way of paying. Individuals already have to forego something to be able to get the services. So there's been arguments that, in fact, it's not going to do a lot in terms of discouraging, and it doesn't bring in a lot of revenue. So, but there are the limitations, as I mentioned before, that the state really has very little latitude in terms of how much it can move copays, given the federal government restrictions.
The classic study of copays, which goes back 35 years, the RAND study, and which has never really been challenged and has been replicated, is that copays basically individuals reduce the amount of care they need by just as much as the care they don't need. So from a medical perspective, it turns out to be a bit of a wash.
I mean, there was an example, and I believe it was in Washington State a few years ago, where there was a substantial increase in copays in the Medicaid population, and there was a very rapid dive in utilization. I think some of that rebounded, but I think there is some evidence and concern that there will be a substantial decrease in utilization. And as you say, it won't necessarily just be in the so-called wasted care. It's not clear that there's a ton of wasted care in this Medicaid population anyway.
And that people are not necessarily able to determine what they need, the sort of the categories of I really need to go versus I think maybe I should go, but I might be all right if I don't. So, okay, so other questions that the panelists have for each other?
Well, can I ask Tom a question, or maybe everybody? Tom, if you're right and most of these Medi-Cal cuts never happen, so the state doesn't save the $1.7 billion, and if Prop 98 still protects education. We heard this morning, you didn't hear them, that corrections is kind of immune for cuts. What does that mean for the rest of state government?
They'll have to find the money there. And I agree, there's not a lot of latitude in terms of, there's not much of a, I mean, you just hit what? Those three items hit on, if you do K through 12, it's about half. And with Medi-Cal, you've probably got, what, 20% of the budget left? And it really means that you have to haul a lot out of it. And so it's a problem. But I do, I am fairly skeptical about the ability of the state to be able to cut at this point.
I would be curious on the opinion of others, but my understanding is that as long as this sort of gets scored and it's acceptable, the analyst office agrees that thinks that there will be reductions, then this will go into the budget and we'll miss the budget and it will add to the state debt. And then next year they'll have to decide whether they're going to believe that this is going to
help or not. What happens next year is if you lose $1.7 billion, it comes back next year as $3.4 billion. Because you got to restore the prior year
so
and the next year.
You're kicking it down the road. But.
Yeah.
But that's still the best way to bet.
Someday, California will end up not being able to borrow any more money is
right.
The problem.
I mean, right now the problem is yeah, that's true. The state has to have a prospective balance. And it pretends like it's going to get a lot of revenue it doesn't get. It doesn't get it, and it falls short. And it's accumulating. That's why we're at $25 billion now. And it'll grow further. Yeah. So
and the question is how fast revenues come back, and it's probably not very fast. But.
Right. I did have a few comments. I mean, I don't want to throw a wet blanket on long term, but I'll do a little throwing of a wet blanket because I work a lot in these areas, and I know why CBO doesn't score, the Congressional Budget Office doesn't score savings on these. If you take ACOs, for example, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has a number of demos, like the PGP. They didn't save money. So, it's like I hear a lot about ACOs being able to save money. Nobody understands how it's going to work, and the demos they haven't saved anything. So if it's going to happen, nobody understands now how it's going to happen. As far as coordinated care, that's another area where it sounds very good, but they don't save money. They often will do a little better in terms of improvement in care, but that's why the Congressional Budget Office will give you nothing for coordinated care in terms of treating the high-cost patients in a more coordinated way, because there's demo after demo that CMS has run, and then anybody who has one of these programs that thinks they work, they can get them demoed at CMS, and there's tons of these, and none of them save money. So it'd be nice to have it happen. Also, I was going to mention the comparative effectiveness centers that have been set up are potentially interesting, but they can't consider costs, and they don't consider costs explicitly. So literally, if you have a procedure that's 10 times more expensive than another, you're supposed to adopt it. That's all they can't, and they can't even talk about the cost differential. So that's not exactly promising for us going forward in terms of what's going to happen on the cost side, because they're not even set up to do this. Let me mention price controls. I mean, price controls may save money. We already have price controls in Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, that's one of the main areas I work on, is trying to rebundle and figure out how you do reimbursements to save money. So Medicare and Medicaid, and prices aren't high in Medicaid, so you may think we can ratchet this down and do more controlling, but I don't quite understand what the vehicle is. It's certainly not in Medicare. I don't know what the vehicle is either. I mean, there's utilization issues, and you might want to do in the service, but price controls, we have them. CMS is changing them all the time.
I think the argument there is that if you were to bring in the rest of the sector, of the private sector, then there would be more effective potentially. And right now, if you just push on one part of the balloon,
it's a multiple payer issue.
I got it. If you're worried about total health care costs and you understand in the United States, I understand. If you're worried about Medicare costs, which we are, I don't. Already ratchet the prices down. I mean, there are price controls. That's all I'm saying. Is you guys may have another way of thinking of how to impose them. I don't know what they would be, because almost every idea under the sun is basically there on the pay for performance. It's just difficult.
They're
blowing up like everything.
Let me take to each of those sort of in reverse, and I don't entirely disagree. But on the payment, we're looking at there's a considerable cross subsidy and cross shifting now, and we're trying basically to get those to gradually squeeze that out without ruining payment networks and all that. Comparative effectiveness. Your point is totally well taken about not considering costs, but it's actually a giant step even to compare, take the simple step of comparing things to see which works and which doesn't. A few years back, the They tried to do this at ARC, government entity, for spinal procedures, and the spine surgeons basically shut the entire entity down. So if, I mean, that gives you some sense of the lobbying going on and the difficulty, but even to make these sort of baby steps, it's a first, you know, it's a line that's drawn that can get you to, you know, actually doing what you want, which is cost-benefit analysis, which other countries do, if not with abandon, at least regularly. ACOs, the point is well taken there. It's a couple of jokes that always make the round in the healthcare circuit that ACO stands for an all-consultant opportunity, which is completely true. And the other one is that it's, you know, ACOs are like a unicorn. Everybody knows what it looks like, but nobody's actually ever seen one. I mean, those are true things. On the other hand, and this is the point I was trying to make, the principles that are behind ACOs are the ones which are embodied in what I think of as the best performers in those systems that are trying to integrate care already in the country. So they're not necessarily accountable care organizations, and frankly, we don't even know what the final regs are from the federal government for what an ACO is. But it's clearly designed to give a leg up to the Kaiser-like systems that at least some would argue, and I would argue, have gotten, you know, better bang for the buck in caring for their beneficiaries. So it's an attempt, I think, all these to nudge the system in the right direction. And the question is, and Tom makes it very well, whether this will just be a ripple that sort of disappears or whether there's any sort of permanent traction gained.
Okay, let's take the pulse of the audience. Two or three questions, if folks have things you've been thinking about that you'd like to ask the panel.
In terms of general medical costs rising, you mentioned that doctors are paid a lot less in European countries. And as I understand it, part of the reason why they can put up with paying a lot less is that they come out of medical school with a lot less debt because the government subsidizes that. And they don't have to pay huge medical insurance, malpractice insurance costs because that's also subsidized. Is there any thought out there about adopting one of those approaches to our local systems?
Even taking into account the medical debt in this country and taking into account malpractice premiums that individuals have to pay, that providers have to pay, physicians in the U.S. still make multiples of what European providers make, in particular specialties. The primary care docs, not multiples, but still they make substantially more than in Europe.
Yeah, I should note one thing that California at least started, I don't know where they are at this point, is to try to increase enrollment in med schools, you know, try to just increase supply and, you know, allow more doctors in from. Actually, do you know where that is, Stan, in terms of doing that? Because I don't, obviously with the budget, it's been a problem to be able to expand the enrollment, but that has been one of the motivations is to try to expand. I mean, Stanford's medical school, their class is 130 individuals per year.
And
where you kind of look at it, it's like kind of unbelievable.
And when you think
their own room,
when you think at the state level, what the state can do, addressing scope of practice issues is one of those things that is incredibly frustrating to at the federal level. That scope of practice for mid-level providers, non-physician providers, is something that's determined at the state by individual states. There are very strong lobbies by, you know, physician groups not to expand scope of practice, but that is sort of one step that you could envision at the state level in a crisis such as this might actually have more traction.
And thank you very much for a great panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.